Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm John Purcell, and I'm sitting here with Warren Mundine to talk about his memoir, In Black and White, Race, Politics and Changing Australia. Welcome, Warren.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
I've been reading this over the weekend, and I get to read a lot of political memoirs in my job, and a lot of them are somewhat painful. I won't name which ones. I found this so interesting. I picked it up, sort of have a quick flick through, and I found myself 2 hours still sitting there reading from chapter one, going right through. Right. Your family history is eye-opening for me, as I've not read anything similar to this. Mm. You dedicate the book to your mum and dad. Yeah. How proud are you of them in the way they made or brought you up?
Well, it's like two different worlds that I live in now, and compared to their world, and plus the world I was growing up with them. You know, we lived in a very tiny house in South Grafton, and they lived in even smaller places. Like my dad used to sleep on the ground when he was growing up, out at Byugal. And the strength they had, the strength of character, they're very high, you know, very morally, very high, had really strong, you know, ethics, you know, and, you know, but they was also a very, very kind person. There wasn't a person they turned away from the door. They've always had a, they took on, you know, took on relatives who got, you know, had problems and that, and you know, at any given time we had about 20 people in the house when I was a kid. So that sort of strength of character, of no matter what happens in your life, you just punch through it, you just move forward, and life can be great. They always had this great thing about life is fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, they in your book you do describe that they're, because of the way in which they were a bit reserved, and you determined not to be like that with your kids.
Yes.
But something within that, I better set the scene. I mean, you've got the 20 people in the house, but there's 8 boys and 3 girls that they had in the house as well, just as your core.
Yeah, that's a core. Then we had our grandparents at various times, and we had several cousins who come and stayed with us at several different times as well. But yes, there was good, and like every human being, there's good and bad things. You know, like their reserve, which was, I suppose it's a period of the time you got to think about, you know, they were born around the First World War.
Mm.
And this public display of romance and stuff, was they didn't do that. They just, obviously they must have did something. They had 11 kids, but they it was actually my wife Elizabeth pointed one of the photos out to me, that because I said they never seemed to show affections, and then she showed me this photo, and it's really funny. Through the writing of this book, I actually then saw them in a different light.
Mm-hmm.
That there was this love, incredible love between them. You know, they were married up until death, and and my father always, you know, he never remarried. He lived another, oh, gee, how long after that? 10, 15 years after my mother died. And he was always in his thoughts and stuff like that. So it was a very strong romance between them. But I never saw him kiss in public, never seen him hold hands.
Yeah. And was that a normal upbringing? Was it different to people that you knew and your relations were having in Australia? Because the way in which we're presented within, I suppose, the modern media, way that the different representations are, there was really no one looking after themselves, no one getting on and doing it. Mm. Your parents owned their own home and they looked up. I think it's kind of a shorthand to describe.
Yes.
But even your grandparents looked after themselves at their own home.
Yes.
Your father was a manager of a
sawmill.
Sawmill.
And also his father and that, they did farming and that. So it was more about independence. They had this very independent streak about
that part,
it. And their attitude was, you know, we'll make our own way in life. And they were very good in that it didn't matter whether you were the richest bloke in town or the poorest bloke in town, as long as you got up every morning and worked and did things, they respected that. They had a lot of respect for
it. Yeah, I liked your father's version of what a good person and a bad person was. Yeah. A worker or a non-worker.
Yeah, yeah. That's right. It was very old-fashioned stuff. And he had a very old labour things, you know, about working. You work no matter what you did, you know, whether you're the midnight man and went and collected the dunnies, or you worked in a law firm, you're a worker, you work. And in fact, they like people who you could actually, you know, they could point to what they did. So, for instance, my dad had the terrible thing, which I've now inherited, of driving along and going, see that bridge over there? And we go, yeah. And he said, I built that bridge. And then that road over there, I built that road. Now, I find myself driving around Sydney because I worked in the water board and did sewer lines. I say, see that suburb over there? And they go, yeah, I did the sewer line there. It's a curse. You end up repeating your parents. But there was one thing I was definitely going to do. Mainly my father. My mother was very affectionate to us, but my father was that I was not going to not show my kids that I loved them. I didn't love them. I loved them, and I made sure that they knew that.
Yeah. What is really clear through reading through the book is the development of your ideas, because there is, you were at one point you were seen as the president of the Labour Party.
Yeah, some ruthless bastard, is that?
Yeah, sort of wheeler and dealer behind the scenes kind of thing.
Yeah.
The next minute you're working for the Liberal Party, and so there's this kind of sense of, oh, he's turned on his ideals. Yeah. But when you read this, it doesn't seem that way. It seems like there's a kind of a slow progression of putting all these life experiences together to formulate the ideas that you now hold. Is that intentional, or is that just, that's how it was?
It wasn't actually intentional, but I think politicians forget why they're there. They're there to improve people's lives, to get things better for people. And I think, especially in the modern politics in the last 10 years, 12 years, it's become very spiteful in that. And you don't get caught up in an ideological trap in saying, oh, just because it doesn't fit in my ideological thinking doesn't mean it's a bad idea. It could be a good idea. And at the moment, you know, in the past we used to have politicians crossing floors and the Labor Party supporting some ideas that the Libs did and the Libs supporting other. We don't get that anymore. And so I always grounded myself, because all the politicians and that I met, and look, they're all great, they work very hard. Despite what people think, I reckon they're probably the hardest workers I've ever met. They, you know, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, got to turn up for a school hall opening, got to turn up to some Rotary Club meeting, got to do this and do that. And but at the same time, you know, make sure you did your readings and you're ready for the parliamentary sitting, and then also doing your numbers to make sure you still got a job the next day. And so they're very, very, very hard-working people. But at the same time, I think they get caught up in this echo chamber, because Parliament House in Canberra is 6,000 people work there. It's huge, and you don't hardly get out of it when you're there. And so you get this echo chamber approach. So I always made sure that when you're thinking about a policy, when you're thinking about a vote, you first stop is, okay, is this good? Is this going to get a person a job?
Hmm. And has that caused problems in your life, especially more in recent life? But one thing that you get through this is your connection with the actual voters themselves seems to be there the whole way through. Like with the you were trying to get someone else to run for
Dubbo City Council. Yeah,
Dubbo City Council. Then you pulled out at the last minute, so you had to write your own name down. And so you wrote your own name down. And then because of the way it was all set up at that particular time, and the Nationals had always won, they weren't really keeping an eye on it. So you came up with a plan with the Independent to get to make sure that... so you went door to door, and no one had done that. And you spoke to...
Yeah. It was a massive challenge for me too, because... It may sound funny, but I'm an introvert and I suffer from anxiety and that. So I have these little things I do, like I'm doing at the moment, playing my fingers, so I could talk to people and be interviewed and stuff. So I thought about it. I said, what do I like? I'd like, if a person's running for apartment. I'd like him to come and have a chat to me.
Mm.
And I said, okay, I've got to go out and have a chat. So I had to really work hard on actually walking up to someone's door, knocking on that door and saying, hi, I'm Warren Mundine, vote for me. But it was a great experience. You know, I had some fun things. I remember I was in Narromine and knocked on the door and this woman said, wait a second, I've got to get dressed. So it was a very hot day that day. And the other things that one bloke, he set this dog on me. And I said, well, and he's screaming at me, I've been voting for One Nation since 1975. And I thought, well, One Nation hasn't been around that long. But it was a good view of people. I think you've got to keep yourself grounded. There's an old Will Rogers, the movie cowboy star, he had this saying, I've never met a person I didn't like. Well, I'll be honest, I've met people I don't like. I don't hate. Hate's a terrible thing, but I didn't like them. But every person I've been in my life has taught me something and I've learned something from.
And you've always, the other thing which was, I think, attractive to voters and to, you know, and caught the eye, I think, of the Labor Party was how straight you were with the media.
Yeah.
You just said it as it was, which got you in trouble occasionally when you sort of
didn't
say what was expected. But on the other hand, in this environment, when we're hearing all the people with their practiced statements and avoidance, for someone to actually say it as it is on TV, it's so refreshing. It stands out. I mean, the interview you did with Kerry O'Brien around all the infighting of the Labor Party and Beasley and this and you know, who's going to lead them to the next election, and you're just telling them, get their bloody act together.
I don't like to mince words. I just like to be straight with people and do things. Because, you know, my brother Roy, he had it. I always pick up these little sayings. He had this saying, you know, bad news doesn't get better with time. And stuff. So I just say, look, this is, you know, if we're going to win the election, no good arguing amongst ourselves, and we're seeing it currently at the moment, arguments within parties, is you've got to be focusing on the voters. You've got to be focusing on the people out there, listening to them and then delivering on them. And that doesn't mean just they tell you something, you've got to deliver everything they tell you. Because sometimes you just got to take them on a journey. And this is why people like the Hawke Keating and Howard years were so, inspired me so much, is because they went and said to people, this is going to be tough, but we're going to take you on this journey, and in a few years' time, things are going to get better. And when I bought my first house, you know, I was paying 18% interest on that. I couldn't imagine that today. But we trusted them. We trusted them and voted for them. And I think, politicians today are in the happy business. We're trying to make people happy.
Yeah, and that ain't moving us forward, is it?
No. Sometimes, you know, anyone who's ever had children or had to look after children, sometimes you've got to be tough.
So one thing, one of the many things that I found very interesting here is, for me, I got an education in Aboriginal history and also in that there is no Aboriginal history. There's a whole range of nations and different points of view and that attempt at certain periods, 60s and 70s, to try and put it under one name, which I can understand why they would try and do that. But it then caused issues and it didn't. One rule won't fit all. Mm. But also, when you talked about native title and you talked about the referendum and then the effect the referendum had, there were lots of people in work, although they weren't getting paid, although they're not getting paid a lot. And when they were given equal pay, they lost those jobs and then they relied on the government. And that was a big shift within Australia.
Yeah, it's something people really haven't caught up to in the wider picture. There was I can't actually remember the name, but Something Sky, there was a movie done in Western Australia about it, where here was these people working on this sheep station. It was on a sheep station, and then they equal pay come in, they lost their jobs, and they lived on the fringes of towns in country Western Australia. I thought they missed some of the great stuff that could come out of the personal stuff that could have come out of that. I thought that was a bit too superficial, you know, because here you had people who were very proud people, and even though they were getting no money, getting at least they had accommodation and food, and their kids were getting some education and that. And then the next morning they got up and they were told you have to leave, and they're gone. They got driven into the Aboriginal reserves, and they got driven into the fringes of towns. And these are the people who saw themselves as really independent, because there were Aboriginal reserves out there where people were completely controlled by the mission managers and that, and had no say in their life. But these people saw themselves as independent. Even though I'm getting no money, I'm getting loaves of bread and some bit of meat now and again, or I'm getting £5, I'm independent. And they were very strong, independent people. And all of a sudden, they were forced to live on the fringes of town. And they had a huge psychological as well as a physical approach to their lives. And that was, and we're seeing the results of that. And I remember back in the 1975, the old fellas, the elder fellas, who were strong cattlemen, you know, they were rough as guts. They were wiry people. And they said, look, they come up with the term sit-down money. They said, look, when they were told, oh, you're going to get welfare now, you're going to be looking, and they sat there and they're thinking, what, we get paid for doing nothing? And they said, yeah, we'll give you money. And they said, what, sit-down money? You get paid for sitting down? They couldn't quite understand that. And that's where the Aboriginal term sit-down money come from.
And so after Mabo and after Native Title, it started to spread around, people started to get control of their land. It seems to me that you saw that as kind of, or they seemed to want to make it a communal thing. And your experience with your parents and the thing they passed on to you was get your own house, get your own independence, make sure you got a job.
Which is almost the Australian, general Australian thing. Yeah,
Well, I mean, it's not just Australia, it's every damn culture, it seems like. You know, if you go around the world, everyone wants to have their little bit that they own, and communism didn't quite
understand. No, communism fails. It's a miserable failure.
Yeah, and so you know, kibbutz in Israel, they try to do it and it fell apart. You know, there's a whole range of people who had these ideals and these utopias that they
sort of set up. Kibbutzes are now the centre of capitalism. They do incredible stuff.
Yeah. So you stood up in front of, I can't remember where it was, but you got up in front of the Aboriginal leaders and gave a speech, which was about...
Oh, yeah, the Native Title Conference.
You're very brave to get up there and just give that speech, but the speech was around, should we start talking about private ownership within these native titled areas?
Yes, that's right.
Then it was ridiculously controversial, and you had people, but people listened. You know, were able to.
They did politely after.
How long has it been since then?
That was 2004, 2005. My life is pretty tough from about that period when I put out this idea that, and really I do believe in disruption. So you have to, if things are not moving ahead, you have to shake it up a little bit. And so I always believe that you've got to have, you know, own your own home, you've got to work, you've got to get your kids educated. That's empowerment. That empowers you to do things. And I remember having a conversation, this is when I was national president, years later, with the Chinese government in 2006, and they had this thing, they said, we are here not to be pushed around anymore. And it's not that we're going to be military government, because most of their military is about controlling their own people, rather than, they said, we're going to become an economic power, and that's going to make us a very powerful force. And I always thought that was interesting. I've read about a lot of people, you know, going back over the years, and reread them again, and I thought, okay, this the only way for us to get real empowerment is economic empowerment, is that we can control our own lives. And even though you may be like the old cattlemen and sheep on the sheep stations and the cattle stations and that, were getting some less money in that, but they decided what they did with their money. They decided where they went and where they didn't go. Well, the ones who were on the missions and that, they were trapped in that, and they weren't able to do that.
Were you just a bit early because it was a fragile, it'd just been won and it was fragile, no one wanted to even breathe just in case it disappeared?
Look, I understand that's true, because they were very nervous about this whole thing. Hey, we just got our land and you're talking about it now, splitting it up and doing it. So I said, look, there's many ways of doing that. So I wanted them to think about it, and I got to give credit to them. even though they tried to murder me at the time, by 2008, so 2004, 2005, we had this discussion. By 2008, they said, yes, we want to have home ownership. And they started shifting to a more business case. So in the last 10 years in Aboriginal Affairs, it's just amazing growth in thinking about, okay, we want to run our own businesses because that creates job, that creates economic power for our communities. And you know, we're still having these discussions, but at least we're having them.
And where do you sit now after all this long journey? You went to university, you got involved in activism, you then got involved in politics, then you found yourself crossing over between two warring ideologies, and your relationship with the Aboriginal activism and also just Aboriginal people has come in and out. Do you feel that things are coming round at this point?
I do. I think we're moving slowly, but we're starting to pick up pace in that. Some of the things that I look back to in this short period when I was chair of the Prime Minister's Indigenous Advisory Council starting in 2003 to 2017 was policies like the Indigenous Procurement Policy. That was a Canadian idea. We took that idea, shook it up, and it's like 1st of July 2015, $6.7 million was going to Aboriginal businesses. As of the 1st of July 2017, it's $500 million. Ooh. So in 2 years, we were able to shift. In fact, I was at the UN talking with the Canadian delegation there, and they said, we looked at that policy and said, how did you do it? We had it for 20 years, and we couldn't move it, new blokes get it, and within a couple of years it's bang, it's off, gone. And so we're actually working with them and advising them to do that. So it's about getting people to move ahead and getting real control. When you've got to accept money from the government, and there's certain times of your life you may have to because certain things may have happened, you got injured or you got laid off, but at the end of the day, if you continue to do that, you just become an extension of the government.
Yeah, and where do you sit now within, are you welcomed within the regional activism sphere, or are you still an outsider? Where do you sit?
Look, in public there's some arguments in that there, but some of my more crazy, some general public would call them radical mates, we sit and have beers, we talk, we still have discussions, because I like to collect ideas and thoughts and conversations, and that helps me shape ideas from there and then chuck them out there for people to beat it up, jump on it, try and kill it or love it. And so I still talk to them, I still the Labor Party people. Some people didn't quite get how I could work with the two different political spheres. At the end of the day, governments change quite regularly in Australia. So if the Aboriginal community was just going to put all their eggs into one basket, there's 50% of the time they're going to have no say.
Mm.
So I said, we need to be able to talk to both sides in politics, because both sides in politics are just as bad as each other in how they treated us. So we need to be able to get our viewpoints across that bipartisan approach. And I think that's slowly working through. And you've seen the number of Aboriginal people now standing for the Nationals and the Labor Party and the Liberals. So,
Oren, thank you so much for coming and talking to us. I'm really enjoying the book and I'm learning a ton. And it's very interesting. It's changed some of my ideas, which is probably the point of writing a book, is to try and get people to start thinking about their own ideas and see if you can influence them or put another perspective forward. And I found it very interesting.
I find two things in life. One is nothing greater than being able to give a person a job, because you change generations of people. And there's nothing greater than making people think.
Yeah. Thank you, Warren.
Thank you.
And you can get hold of Oren Mundine's In Black and White, Race, Politics and Changing Australia at booktopia.com.au right now.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.